That is the lowest of the low. The album is Sordid Fiction, and are they going to spill us some Sordid Fiction today, or is it going to be all truth? We
all
got
above the board.
Steven and Ron Hawkins here. real pleasure to have you on the show, boys.
Thanks.
It's you know, I try to pretend I'm as professional and objective as possible, but I got to be honest with you guys. One of the main reasons that I'm doing this show and a fanatical music nerd today is because of your record, Shakespeare My Butt. When I heard that at a time in my life when I was just sort of growing up and wanting to hear something intelligent and something interesting, but yet I was still, you know, enjoying the pop stuff that I heard on the radio, and yours was such a perfect blend of that. It had the melodies and the energy of the pop music, but it just had those awesome lyrics and just a great energy. And so thank you very much for that record and all you've done since.
No, thanks, Jeff. That's what it is, yeah.
It's so the brief history of the band for folks that don't know, you came out with that record, 1991?
91,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then put out another one a few years later, and then you went and busted up just when things were heating up and took a bunch of years off.
Yeah, but almost 6 years off, and then put it back together, and as Ron said the other day, we've been together longer this time than we were the first time. So
during the layoff, I mean, you guys had been hearing about people were still enjoying the record and people were buying them, I guess, more than even they were when you were together, it seemed, mm-hmm. right? So was there, how did you get pressured into playing together, or did it sort of just come together naturally?
I wouldn't say it wasn't pressure. There was constantly a voice saying, why didn't you guys do this? Why didn't you guys do this?
Yeah.
Different people were sort of interested in us trying it.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until after about 5.5 years that a promoter in Toronto named Elliot Lefko said to us and gave us a sort of a proposal of a bunch of shows we could do and come back and do them properly, that we said, okay, well, we'll sit down and talk about it.
Steve, I don't want to unveil this on Winnipeg Radio, but no, Elliot had called John and I about 3 different years in a row.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
See, because the band wasn't really talking to each other, right?
Yeah.
So our former manager in Vancouver and Elliot Lefko, who was a promoter in Toronto, had called me and had called the bass player for about 3 years in a row, and we had just, like, out of the gate said, no, forget it, there's no way it's going to happen.
Right.
And then that last, so there was pressure definitely for a few years, but then that last year, I don't know why we decided to take it to the band, but we at some point had sort of loosened up enough about the idea to bring it to the band and discuss it, which led to getting together to have brunch and talk about it.
Right.
Which is a big thing people do in Toronto, apparently not anywhere else is brunch, but
yeah.
But we went and just discussed it together. And that was, like, every step of the way was very awkward. It was like having, you know, being a newborn again, because every step was sort of like people sort of looking at each other suspiciously across the table.
Yeah,
And then when everything just seemed like, well, this just seems too easy and too relaxed, and all the good stuff from back in the day seems to be here, but none of that tension.
Right.
We just then took it to a rehearsal, and then that sounded really, well, the first rehearsal sounded terrible, but it felt really good.
Yeah.
And then, you know, so every step of the way was like that. Well, let's, you know, have a rehearsal. Well, then let's do these shows, you know.
Right.
And we had no intention of doing anything more than those shows. But
right.
And then every step just felt so good that we thought, well, you know, going to the studio can't be. We had an opportunity to go in the studio and record 3 songs that were added to a double live disc
right.
we did.
Yep.
So that was kind of a no-pressure way to test out how it would be in the studio. And so everything, that was my read on it. It was like that mm-hmm. every step was sort of greeted with suspicion, but then quickly became easy.
Right. Know? Well, I guess I'm not sure what the other guys were up to. You guys sort of disappeared, but Ron, you certainly went on and had a bit of a career building yourself with the Rusty Nails.
Mm-hmm.
So you probably had the most to lose as far as the ground you had made up without the lowest of the low. Would this harm sort of that solo career? Were you thinking that in your head? And were you reluctant to jump in after you had spent so many years trying to distance yourself from the past? Or
I can't... I think there was certainly a certain amount of like, well, what does this mean as far as the forward movement goes? But I mean, luckily or unluckily, it happened at a time where the Rusty Nails were kind of reaching a bit of an impasse in terms of like guys in the band couldn't tour.
Oh yeah,
and it was becoming a bit more difficult to. I think the environment in Canadian live music was becoming harder anyway, and
right.
it was getting harder to sell records and harder to tour. And then we had people in the band that were becoming difficult to tour with, and we actually wound up turning down. A Warped Tour with the Mighty Mighty Boss Tones.
Oh.
And that was a really big bummer for the Rusty Nails, because it was like, well, if we can't take advantage of opportunities like this, then what are we going to do, idle, you know, in neutral for years?
Right.
So that it's not that that had anything to do with the doing the reunion shows with DeLo. That was all about sort of coming home and healing old wounds and getting together with my brothers again. But it kind of was convenient that the Rusty Nails weren't a house on fire by the time the most DeLo thing happened. And then and then we just decided to pick up and, you know, get back at what we were doing.
And I know you guys are certainly not in this for the money. So I know that there must have been some sort of, we don't want to be seen as just going out there because we can make money as the lowest of the low. Right. You had to have some justification for doing it, I would imagine.
Well, beyond, yeah, I think after the six shows that we did as a reunion, it became that. We started to add new stuff to the set. And it's funny, though, there is definitely a perception that bands doing this sort of thing are doing it for the money. And, you know, like,
but some bands are doing it for the money.
Some bands are, but at this level, no, we're not doing it for the money.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, it'd be nice to have some money. It'd be nice to, you know, but
I mean, even in 94, when you know, people talk about how we broke up when we were, you know, on the threshold of blowing way up and everything. I mean, as far as we were concerned, we built it as a grassroots thing from 91 on. Like, we had come across touring and we worked really hard. Like, there were years, I think there was a year where we clocked like 250 shows in a year.
Mm-hmm.
So we had always worked really hard at it. By the time the success was kind of catching up to us a little in 93, 94, we felt that we'd been working hard for a very long time.
Yeah.
And we had felt that we'd been quite successful in Canada for quite a long time. And there was that sense, I think, that we had a little bit of an attitude like A&M at the time. Was it A&M at the time, I guess? Which is now Universal.
Yeah.
That there was a certain co-opting going on. Like, you know, we had wanted help earlier on in our careers and didn't get it. But then when we had made it sort of a going concern ourselves, then we were swooped in upon by a whole bunch of record labels, which always happens. But I think it's that was, you know, we sort of figured hooking up with a label like A&M would make the administration part of it and just it would make it easier for us to just stick to the making the art, getting on the road and playing.
Right.
And it just became so much hassle and so much pressure and so much stuff from the top down that, you know, that was one of the major reasons that it sort of blew up.
Yeah, and they constantly didn't understand why we made the decisions we made. Like, I think one thing we did really well was we really had a very sound idea of how we wanted to control how the band grew, and that we wouldn't do things that just were there for the sake of doing and didn't make us sort of feel like we were moving forward.
Right.
So consequently, we turned down, like, you know, a huge five-night stand in BC with Bryan Adams and turned down tours with the Bare Naked Ladies and stuff like that. And they were always like, well, what do you mean? Like, I mean, that's what a band does. But to us, it just none of that felt right or felt like it was going to help our career or help our souls as musicians. So we just turned them down. And there was that constant sort of struggle between our ideologies and theirs. So.
Right. So getting back together, though, when it finally came time to make a new record, was it sort of like, now you have a chance to do things your way, and did you fight to get things done your way and make sure that you didn't have to do things that you didn't want to do and that things were being put out your way and done the right way this time?
Mm-hmm. Well, ironically, I mean, the fact that there was a buzz, I mean, it's sort of like we just came home to, it's almost like we came home full circle to the way it was in 91, which is that the people making a buzz about us playing were, you know, record buyers and people who go to live shows and stuff like that. And, you know, in some parts of the promotion industry in Toronto. But so we got back to doing it. And it's not like there was, you know, people busting our door down for a new record in any major labels or small labels or anything. So we went into making the record completely unhindered. You know, we just made the record we wanted to make.
On your own?
Yeah, on our own, with our own money, and the great thing about it was that we incorporated Steven had a solo project during that period of time as well, so he'd done a lot more writing on his own than he had previously done with The Lowest of the Low, and then I had the Rusty Nails, so we kind of had all these influences that we could bring in that were new.
Right.
And I had worked with the Rusty Nails with Ian Blurton in Toronto, producing Rusty Nails records, and then the Lowest of Low did some demoing with him, and he's a person we really respect and consider kind of like, he's very like-minded to us, and he's been in the scene in the same way we have, in a very grassroots way with Change of Heart and Blurtonia and stuff like that. So he was kind of like a sixth member at that point, you know, and his opinions and everything were very, you know, held a lot of weight. So we went and made this record, and we made it on our own and with our own decisions and our own drive, and I think it just sort of accumulated, you know, certainly we weren't jettisoning our old Lowest of the Low sound, but like there was that, and then there was all the stuff that we learned in the meantime put into the stew as well, and we're pretty proud of it, and and it felt very much like it was a piece of forward work. So that's why it's sort of a double whammy when people suggest that we're at all in this for the money, or b that we're trying to recapture what we did in the early 90s, yeah. because we really don't feel that's the case.
Yeah. For someone like me, looking in on the outside, I'd seen the reunion shows and stuff and thought you sounded good, but it was mostly older stuff. And mm-hmm. so when you went in to do a new record, I was very, very curious to find out whether you could still do it, whether you would, you know, draw from the same pile you'd done before, or whether you'd do something completely different. So there was a lot of expectations, I would imagine, on the parts of the fans. But did you feel pressure to outdo what you had done before, or do the same thing that you had done before, or...
I don't think we felt any pressure in any way. I think that's, as much as Shakespeare My Butt is a bit of a sort of a, you know, both a gold medal and an albatross around our necks. It's like it didn't influence how we looked at this record. And when we made that record, we didn't feel any pressure. It was just something we did. We just did that record, and people happened to like it.
Yeah.
And I think there was a lot of the same attitudes with this one. I don't think there was any sort of sense of we've never had any sort of calculated discussions about this is the type of record we're going to make. We let it all happen fairly organically. There was discussion on this record about how we were going to construct it after the songs were there, and I think that was premeditated, and Ian was involved in a lot of that. But pressure, I think Ron said it before, there wasn't any. I mean, there was no pressure from the outside that you had to make a record like this. We've talked about that a bit too, because our label Maple wasn't involved in any of the sort of ordinary A&R decisions, and I'm not sure if they will plan to be from this point on. But you know, we just did what we wanted to do.
So the record, I mean, obviously you must be happy with it, having done it your way, and I think it's a wonderful record, and I think it captures what I loved about the band before, but takes me to a new place, because we're all a little older and a little perhaps a little more intelligent than we were in 1991, and I think a lot of that is captured in the record. But did folks who liked you back in the day, was that sort of the similar reaction, or do you think you lost some fans from back then?
Well, it's a double-edged sword when you do.
Does it matter?
Yeah, like unfortunately, I don't think it matters. I mean, like we've never. I mean, as much as we respect our audience, and I think we've always tried to be engaged with what we're doing, and just be in the moment and be there with it. We've never let any perceived audience desires from us dictate where we're going, because I mean that's a crazy thing to try and do anyway, because you can never know, you know, what is really going on in the.
Yeah.
Like, there's no sort of audience zeitgeist you can sort of tap into and go, okay, well, obviously the audience wants us to go here.
Yeah.
You know, so, I mean, I've lost track of what I was going to say about it.
Well, I think it's a good question, though, because I think there is, when there's a gap in a band's history, as there is with ours, I think maybe people have a harder time picking up the path. And I think on this tour, I think we've noticed more sort of, you know, overall reaction being good for both new songs and old songs. I mean, there's still a clear, people love to hear some of the songs from Shakespeare, and that's relevant for sure. But I mean, I think for us, the next record may sort of dispel that even more. That we're not just a band that got back together to do one album and call it a day.
Yeah,
unless we do just one album and call it a day.
Mm. But like as far as losing audience members, like certainly when we went, I mean, that's the great thing about doing the reunion shows was that. That's what they were, reunion shows.
Yeah.
This is here we are coming back to do sort of what we did, basically what we did in 1993, 1994.
Yeah.
And you can catch us sort of at the height, because I think we're a much better band than we were in 1994. Played the songs in, you know, much more...
with a new 2001 fractured take, though.
On our homespun early 90s sound. But lots of people got a chance to come out and do that. But then when that was done, that's exactly what that was about when that was over. It was like, well, we have a choice of just going on and being, you know, playing, you know, like Chuck Berry, and just going and playing our old hits constantly, or moving forward. And we were adamant about the idea that, you know, none of us have any interest in being a reunion band. So, so I think, you know, if we did lose anybody after that who's just not interested in anything post 1994, then quite frankly, we're not interested in them coming out to the shows. If they want to, they can. But I mean, we're all about playing our whole new record and bits and bytes from the old stuff.
Right.
You know, but it's weird because there's not a lot of bands in this boat where they had only two records. Broke up for a while, there was yet still enough interest for them to come back, and now they're back this much longer, because, like, you know, we always talk about if we'd stayed together and all those Rusty Nail records and Steve's records were part of our catalog, we probably wouldn't be playing very many things off Shakespeare and Hallucinogenia anyway,
right?
Because we'd have just continue to move forward. So it's right. kind of a weird spot to be in.
Yeah. But you do, I noticed in the live show anyway, you still kind of mix it up a bit. I remember at the last show you played here in Winnipeg, everybody, I don't even know why it is, but everybody loves Bleed a Little Wild Tonight and goes crazy right. for that song. But last time you were here, you mixed it up and changed it into this like slower piano ballad almost. Mm-hmm. And at first I was kind of shocked and went like, You're messing with the song that a lot of us came here to hear. But I think that shows your integrity as a band, that you're willing to change those things and do things differently for your sake and hope that the audience gets it. But there must be in the back of your mind, you know, that some folks are going to be disappointed that you're messing with a song like that.
I think you're probably right, because I think there is a general sort of impression that people want to hear things exactly as they are.
But yeah.
But that being said, I think we've had pretty good results we've done that to maybe three or four songs now where we've changed them fairly radically from the way they were recorded back in the day. And
it's a relationship we're involved in with this audience. It's like, you know, you don't get a haircut and your, you know, your partner says, I'm leaving you, I don't like your haircut. You know, it's like, yeah. it's, you know, the hair's going to grow back, or, you know, we'll be doing these songs or we won't be doing these songs. And it's like, if you're going to be so angry at the band and disappointed because we've rearranged a couple songs or because we didn't play the song you like that night,
yeah,
then, you know, that's not the kind of relationship we want to build with. We want people, I mean, we're kind of old school. Like, we want a career. We want to be like Elvis Costello or like The Clash or like Tom Waits or something, where somebody's interested in your 10 album career.
Yeah.
And they want to know where you're going and what you're doing. Not, you know, I don't know if people do that anymore, but
it's a battle you can never win, too. When I was a kid, I was an usher at Massey Hall in Toronto, and that was, like, every band that ever played Toronto came through that hall.
Right. Because
it was the place that...
Yeah.
And if you remember a band called The Monks?
Yeah,
they had
yeah.
two records out. On the second record at the very end, there was a song called Skylab that was 25 seconds long. They played the show, did every song they'd ever written. It was a great show, and I was standing at the back, and these two guys come walking by me, and one guy turns to the other guy and goes, oh, man, they didn't play Skylab. It's like, well, you can't win, so whatever.
Right.
So you do, like, I think there's, we've talked about this a little bit on this tour, about the way we're wired as musicians in general. We're not, maybe not as much entertainers as we are musicians, because there are bands that can do it, can go out every night and play, you know, Satisfaction, and seem to play it with a little bit of heart. Like, I don't know how that happens. Like,
just
we can't, and that's the way it is.
I mean,
it's just the way
it is. Well, ironically, that's the one major thing I would say that everybody had in common back in the day, was they would say, we like this band because we believe that they're saying it as they feel it.
Right.
And that's all great if what you're saying and feeling is what they want you to say and feel. But if you get to a point where you go, well, we're just not, these five songs, we're just not feeling, we're so far from them now, and we don't, you know, would you rather we go up there and pretend that we believe in them, or would you rather us just put them in the vault and say, that's it for that, you know?
And I think a lot of people would rather pretend we believe in them.
I was wondering about that, in particular you, Ron, because you wrote so much of Shakespeare in My Butt. You wrote it when you were like 20 years old or whatever, I would assume, and now, you know, almost 15 years later, do you feel kind of, how do you feel about those songs? Are you still proud of them, or do you think, well, those are just things that I wrote when I was a kid, and
I'm still, I mean, for the most part, yeah. I mean, there are certainly things, I mean, we've had this conversation in the band about moving forward again, and what, you know, so what's the new canon, like, what are we playing, you know, and we can't, the funny thing is, like, we'll all make a list of eight songs that we are still totally on fire about and want to play, but it's not the same. Each guy has a different eight songs, right? So yeah, it's like, there's certainly songs on those records there are little bits of embarrassment about, or like, you know, wow, I've come so far from there, or, you know, like, or what was I thinking about? But, you know, for the most part, there's lots of stuff on there that I guess what I can do is put myself in my own shoes when I was 25. So that helps, you know?
Because your feet haven't grown.
No, my nose is great. My feet haven't grown.
That was not gold.
That's much more.
I got to think that that as well as pleasing fans who were there from the beginning, you wanted to make some new fans with the latest record. And so, is your audience getting younger now? Or is it just us guys that are getting older that are still coming to the shows? Is there a new audience catching on?
Yeah, there's been lots of.
Yeah, when we came back into the reunions, I think the original thing that struck us all was that the audience was really young.
Yeah,
and
they couldn't have been listening.
Well, we expected to see sort of the old faces, because especially in Toronto, you develop
the old faces.
Yeah. But playing in Toronto, you do see a lot of the same people at every show, and they're really, it was just like, wow, who are these people? And like,
things that people had told me over the years that it had really grown and it was a record and the records had been passed down from older brothers to younger brothers and sisters and stuff, I think was true. And I think that's mm-hmm. that's moved on. The downside maybe right now is that we don't seem to be getting, you know, hardly any radio play, and that's
really
makes it hard.
Still,
to
reach.
Yeah, that's just become a real closed door to bands like us, I think. So
why is that? Is it just because the industry sucks so badly, or is it?
Well, I think it's been sewn up really badly. Yeah. I think there's a sort of a corporate edge of radio that didn't exist when we launched Shakes for My Butt that allowed us in Toronto, and I think places across the country. Yeah. In Toronto, we had four singles that were sort of, as they go, top 10 singles.
Yeah.
Off of that album, and I think across the country maybe a few less, but. But still,
but people are still hearing it. Yeah,
in '92, we were on the Toronto main sort of alternative station. We were the most played Canadian band on their playlist. So,
yeah.
For that to happen now for any band, I mean, there are bands getting play, obviously, but for that to happen to that extent for any band is just unheard of.
But it's the same. It's the same in every industry, every cultural industry, and every industry period. Is that like 2005? There's a sort of gobbling up, a corporate gobbling up of all the mom and pop. Stores, yeah. Record stores, like the right. big box chains. I mean, it's no different in consumer goods than it is in music. They're becoming smaller and smaller venues.
Right.
There's only a few major corporate faces on everything, and other than things like Campus Radio and, not even like there used to be pirate radio stations when way back when we were doing it, and that doesn't seem to be happening as much either.
No.
So I think it's just a lessening of avenues, and we constantly talk about we stepped through a door in 1991 that was open for a brief period of time, and we were sort of lucky, we worked really hard and we had some really good stuff to say, I think, but we also happened to be in a very we're born right at the right time because we got in that door and independent music had just sort of exploded in terms of you could make your own CDs and sell them mm-hmm. from the stage, and you could and it's there were all these opportunities, like Steve said, if a DJ in Toronto on the Edge decided they wanted to play you, they could.
Right.
Whereas now we have lots of champions of us at the Edge that just cannot play our stuff because from the top down they're saying stop playing that.
Really?
Just stop featuring that because we know what you're up to, and the whole thing is basically programmed from elsewhere. So it's so depressing,
So how are people getting the word now? Is it mostly through touring, or are you still going out there to make fans and keep in touch with the fans and tell them what you're up to, or is there, I know your website is a great place to be and lots of people visit that mm-hmm. and stuff. So is it a combination of all those things?
Yeah, it's all of the above for sure. You do like Ron said, we have people in Toronto that like us and will play us when they get the chance to, and word of mouth and playing live's always been a great avenue for us. So that's a main one. And word of mouth. One thing we did in Toronto that was fairly cool. We had the chance to we did a billboard in Toronto that I think garnered some attention. So we're doing anything we can that's sort of not out of our price range to push it forward. And
but certainly the narrowing of those opportunities as well has shown itself. Like it's a very what we're happy to accept now as a successful run of selling this disc is a tenth of what we would have been happy with in 1992 because that's just the way the figures are dictated across the board. Like everybody on Maple, everybody on all these, not just indie labels, but all the major labels too, are selling like a tenth of the records they used to.
Right.
So certainly it's showing on the street. You'll come through town. Even places like Winnipeg and Vancouver that we've played before a lot. You'll go through town and you'll really leave there with a distinct impression that not enough people knew we were even there.
Right.
So things like this are fabulous. They help us get the word out. Because in a lot of towns, it's just a matter of trying to do the street poster thing and hoping people see you.
Right.
Apparently, we're getting a lot of hits on LimeWire. So.
Oh yeah. So. Congratulations. Yeah.
So people are getting the music, anyways.
That's good, and it also must help to have. I know that a lot of other bands sort of champion your cause, and you guys are great at helping out other bands, always have been, I think, at helping out other bands. And the case in point that I always think of is the Weaker Thans. You have such a great relationship with them. And John K. Sampson is always saying how great you guys are, and you guys are always saying how great the Weaker Thans are and stuff like that. So it must help to have that word of mouth and have sort of that community of people who can recommend you to their own fans and whatnot.
Yeah, because, the great way that works is, I guess, in the 97 or something when I saw the Weaker Thans, or I heard the Weaker Thans for the first time, accidentally through Chris Hanna from Propagandhi and through G7 and just got their record cold with a bunch of other records, and the other records kind of left me flat, but that record sort of jumped out, and I sort of made it my mission to sort of meet these guys and see who they were and what was up and everything, and became friends with them.
Yeah.
And so then I was kind of championing them around Toronto, and to the point where I was delivering G7 products on the back of my bike because I was saying to Anna, like, you know, there's stores here that don't even have your stuff. Like, so I was doing them on consignment from the back of my bike for those guys. And so that was great. And I think that helped them a lot when they came to Toronto and, you know, got the word around. And then just now, you know, with our new record and everything, and we just got, they did the chart readers poll again. And John did the write-up for us for Shakespeare in My Butt, which was, you know, was beautiful and really, I don't know, it really helps because I think it really summed up how I feel about that record.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's great. It goes both ways. And we were always like, we were always about the idea of community.
Yeah.
And I'm, I always chuckle because people talk about Toronto as a big, cold place.
Yeah.
But it's got a really vibrant community where musicians really sort of support each other. And
that's great.
You know, sing it to the rafters because you kind of have to. Like, there's nobody else going to do it, you know.
Are you touring with an opening act this time, or is it just a different one sort of every time?
It's just a local. We've been using locals everywhere we go just because it didn't work out to bring somebody this time.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah.
We did the last one with the Marble Index.
Marble Index.
That was good. It was just travel-wise, it was a little tight for us. So.
Yeah. Well, that's good though, and like I say, you're still doing your thing. You still have Victimless Capitalism, the website where you guys sell some stuff from other bands and help them out.
Oh yeah, lots of other stuff.
Yeah,
and I'm a painter, and David, our drummer's a painter, and that stuff's up there too. And like the initial idea of that was to have everything like books and art, and you know, just get stuff out to people with no middleman. You know, get it out stuff that people might not see.
Yeah.
And it's been good. I mean, certainly the publishing end of it has been hard. Like, for some reason, our friends that are writers, their publishing companies don't seem to want to jump on.
Oh, really?
But I don't know what that's about. But
that's too bad. So so what's next? Is there now officially a long-term plan for the band, or are you still just taking it one step at a time, one thing at a time?
Yeah, it's still one day at a time. I mean, we never ever, you know, even back in the day, we never had a five-month plan, let alone a five-year plan.
Yeah.
Like, we only ever looked as far as the record we're on or the next record. And yeah, we've certainly got a pro and cons list about going out touring, and it's building, you know, both sides are building, but the con list is growing pretty huge because it's getting so expensive.
Yeah.
You know, that there are times that we're thinking, well, can we even afford to that's what throws the lie to the money grab thing. It's like, we're out here going like money grab, like we can barely even afford to do this, you know?
Yeah.
So I mean, certainly there's plans to continue, how that will take shape and what it'll look like is a daily, you know, discussion.
Ongoing discussion.
Well, you're not helping yourselves out tonight. It's only $7 to get in to see you tonight, which I just think is ridiculous. And I think that's terrific that such a great band I can go and see for $7 at the Pyramid. That's awesome. And there's actually a couple of opening acts, I think. So it should be a great night of entertainment.
Yeah.
And you guys, I was really impressed with how the shows have gotten better. As time has gone on, because you know sometimes there are the bands that have been around for a long time that kind of, you know, rest on their laurels a bit and maybe don't have the chops that they used to, but you guys seem to be giving it even more than you did back in 91 and 92.
I think the reality there is that, and we've talked about this a lot, like our shows back then were sort of out of control, high octane, and we probably weren't, I mean, our playing wasn't anywhere near where it is now. I think we both, you and I,
but it sort of wasn't about that. It was sort of about the energy, and it was a bit of a circus, right?
Yeah,
because you never knew when it was going to fall apart and what was going on. But
see,
no,
we didn't know that.
No,
we didn't know that back then. We didn't think it was going to fall apart, but it sometimes did.
Well, that's terrific. No, and like I say, it sounds even better than ever, if you ask me. And so I'm looking forward to seeing you tonight, and hopefully lots of other people will as well.
Great.
We'll play some stuff. Let's play something off Sordid Fiction. What do we want to hear? You have a request?
About Casual Overdose.
That's a good choice. Why do we pick that one?
That's
the question I ask when I need a second to cue up the song.
Well, Ron, you explain that. I think it's one of the nicest pieces on the record. It's a very, very different from anything we did in the past, and I just like it. You wrote it. You tell him.
Did you ask what it's about?
No, I just wanted to stall for a few seconds so I could cue it up. But
that's good that we stalled it.
But do you have new material that we might hear tonight, or are there?
Yeah. Yeah, we've got a bunch of stuff. I mean, we had stuff that didn't get on Sordid Fiction, only because it didn't fit the direction of how the record was taking shape.
Right.
In fact, there's one song there that you know that we had that Ian, the producer, argued with us was the best song on the record that didn't make the record.
Because
we didn't quite have it where we wanted it.
Yeah.
And we've got stuff left over from Sordid Fiction that hadn't got recorded. We've got new songs since then, and yeah, we're sort of, I'd say I don't know, we're like halfway.
We're not playing much of it live yet, though.
No, but there's a couple things, right?
There is.
Let's hope so. And with with the lowest of low, obviously it's sort of on the front burner, but are the solo projects, are they still in the back of your mind? Might you do another solo record each, or do you just...
No, I don't know if Steve and I have never talked about it, but I've got ideas. Like, I thought about making a la Phil Oaks, like a capital P kind of political record.
Oh, yeah.
Because it's always been in there, and it's always been, you know, the poetry of the politics, yeah, and the daily life kind of thing. And I've sort of stayed away from anything, you know, capital P politics. But I mean, yeah, I've sort of been thinking about something like that, like just once and for all saying, you know, point blank what I feel,
right,
in that manner. So,
right. And you?
Well, I think I would.
It took a long time for your first, yeah, widespread solo release. So is it going to take equally as long for the next one?
Well, it really depends. I think if we continue to make records, yeah, then my energy will be there.
Yeah.
If not, I'll continue to do something else. I mean, I've got songs coming along too. So
that's good.
I'm a slow writer. That's all there is to it.
Right on. Well, it's like I say, it's a real honor and a pleasure to have you here, and we're looking forward to seeing you tonight at the Pyramid.
Thanks, Jeff.
Los Lolo.